The following commentary is for educational purposes only. Always consult the appropriate tax, legal, or financial professionals before acting on any information heard in this program.
Welcome to the IRA Brothers. I'm Nick Edwards.
And I'm Nathan Edwards.
Last show, Nathan mentioned something that kind of caught my ear and caught my interest, and we've been talking about it a little bit this week, and I think it's probably one of the core fundamental concepts of just kind of general holistic financial planning that a lot of people seem to kind of skip in the process of coming to the decision about what kind of financial planning you're going to do, what kind of process you're going to do to arrive at your objectives. And objectives, Nate, is the key word for this, because what you said last show was people need to focus on objectives-based investing. We get a lot of static out there, a lot of things that distract us, a lot of things that excite us and kind of get our minds off track. But the main thing we need to be focused on really at the end of the day is objectives-based investing. What is that?
First, I just want to say that I really appreciate you saying before all of this that we've been talking about this off and on as if we're just passing. Hey, remember when we talked about the objectives base? Literally, this is a process that we do every single day. I'm glad that you dulled it up a little bit there.
But, well, I want people to know what's really going on behind the scenes.
No, it's like an
outtake
this
show.
So what was the question again?
Well, objectives-based investing. If someone comes in and says, you know, that sounds very fancy. That sounds like an insider word. What is that?
Well, and that's kind of it's become a buzz phrase for the industry. So if you just go to any financial planning site, they'll say, we practice holistic. That's another one. Holistic financial planning, right? Yeah. Objectives-based financial planning. The problem is that we find that a lot of folks aren't actually investing or planning for with any objectives in mind. An objective is essentially just a goal, right? So the question always has to be, what are you trying to accomplish, right? So when somebody comes in, we have to collect information from them, you know, find out where they stand initially, which is things like, you know, what kind of assets do you have? What are you spending on a regular basis? You know, what is your income? A lot of information. Basically, anything that has anything to do with money coming or going or loaned or borrowed. And then the next question is, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, I mean, are you just floating through life? Do you just want to pay your bills? What is it that you're trying to accomplish? And the big one that most people say is retirement, right? Mm-hmm. At such and such age, I would like to retire. And it's amazing to me how few people think about where they're trying to go. I wish people didn't do it, but it's understandable that more folks don't take the time to think about it. But it is amazing to me how many people we see that come in and have never actually thought about what they're trying to accomplish. They're just putting money into an account or a 401k, and then they show up one day or they realize themselves. I answer questions online sometimes, and that's another big one. That how much should I save for retirement? You know, I'm 55 years old. How much should I save for retirement?
Well, it's too late. If you're 55 and asking that question,
what's really amazing is that a lot of folks who ask that question, it's not too late for them. So really, they've been oversaving, which is not a bad problem for you know, a lot of folks. But you have to be going towards a target. And it's not that you have to be going towards a target. If you don't mind living the ascetic lifestyle and just putting everything that you have into a bank account or an investment account, great. You will probably have more than enough money than you need to retire. But it's inefficient. Right. And so having objectives, being able to say that at this date, I would like to be able to retire and have this amount of income, that is an objective. And if we have those numbers and if we can make some assumptions, hopefully conservative assumptions, we can try to meet those goals and objectives or that goal and objective in an efficient manner, which just means that we're getting there without more effort than is necessary.
I have a hypothesis about why this kind of lack of enthusiasm or interest in more detailed planning is permeating society right now. And let me tell you what it is, and you tell me if you think I'm right. And the only time will tell if I'm actually correct in this assumption. But what I'm seeing is people in our parents' generation, so Nathan and I are in the 30, 40-year-old range. Our parents are baby boomers. But their parents came from a generation where people typically worked until age 62 or 65, started collecting Social Security. Most people had pensions back then because they had jobs they were at for most of their lives. They wanted to pay off their house, live off their pensions, and then for most of them, the assets that were transferred down to the kids was usually the real property. They didn't have big 401ks and all this kind of stuff. 401ks didn't exist for our grandparents' generation. And so I think the baby boomer generation kind of learned from the experience of their parents, which was, we don't really need to plan too much because Social Security will take care of us for the next 10 years until we die, and then we'll have a pension to, you know, offset that. And we don't have that many expenses because we paid the house off. But now when people are living well into their 80s and their lifestyles are a little bit beyond a lot of them what we're seeing, their budgets, they're going to be running into a real problem problem over the next few years here because of this delayed planning that a lot of people have done.
And I would say that you're right about that. So, I mean, if we go a couple of generations back, I mean, we had folks that were, that had actually lived through the Great Depression. And our aunt was just telling us a story the other day of how our grandmother was telling her that if she could just have had a half cup of milk, a half cup more of milk, she wouldn't have been hungry the next day. And she just wished so frequently that she could have just gotten that extra half cup of milk. And I mean, that was not that long ago.
Yeah.
And but we know, you know, because we've met these people that have lived through that, that affected them for the rest of their lives. They lived differently. They did spend more money than they had. You know, some did, of course, you know, there's always excess. But so we had a number of generations where people lived pretty conservatively. If they didn't have the money, they didn't spend it, especially post-World War II. You know, when we kind of had the industrial boom around two, and we had good middle-class jobs, people could go and work and get a pension and Social Security. And I think you're absolutely right. They didn't have to put much time into planning for retirement. In fact, I tell people all the time that financial planning as a profession is still in its infancy. I mean, really, maybe in the early to mid-90s, did that become a thing for, you know, the middle class, you know, your average individual? Prior to that, you had hot stock tips coming from your broker, and if you had a lot of money, you might have had a money manager. But really, financial planning is a fairly new thing, but it is quite necessary today, and it's primarily because people spend too much money and haven't saved enough, unfortunately.
So where do you think the primary areas that people, when they're going to, you know, if they're going to try to make their own financial plan or if they're going to hire someone to help them with it, what are the core questions that people need to be asking? And where do you see people sometimes being a little bit off base about the kind of assumptions that they're making? Because you said before we try to use conservative assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
What are some things people are looking for or should be looking for as far as numbers to plug into this thing? And where do you see them being a little off base and get them in trouble?
One of the biggest errors that I see folks make that come in and say, hey, this is what I put together so far. And to be quite fair, I mean, we do see a lot of folks who come in and they've got it together.
Yeah.
I mean, they know what they're doing. They've worked the numbers and they've, and again, those are usually the folks who are being very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've done more than is necessary and they'll end up being fine. But the biggest errors that we see, that I personally see, are folks who use an online calculator and make some assumptions for investment returns that are totally unrealistic. And that's largely because if you go online and say, you know, what should my investments make?
The default setting is 20% a year.
It's 8 to 10 or 12%.
Yeah.
I had a client come in recently that was exasperated. He's like, where are people getting this number from? And I was like, well, you know, they're looking at historical returns of the S&P 500 and so on and so forth. But most people do not want to have, you know, the same risk exposure as the S&P 500 across their entire life. And even if they did, you know, we have things like cash drag, tax drag, that make earning the actual returns of the S&P 500 not realistic. You
well, let's stop right there, because I think from my experience, and I know you'll say the same thing, that people do, you're right, they look at that and they go, well, the average performance of the S&P 500 over the last 50 years is around 10%.
Right.
But that really is an unrealistic expectation. But it should be realistic, because if someone really could buy and hold through that time period, that's what they – now you can't invest directly in the S&P, but let's say an index tracking fund.
Sure.
You would have had a rate of return close to that, yet very, very few people get that. And why?
It's typically because people are overcome with their emotions and they buy into and get out of the market. I saw an article a long time ago, said, and I can't remember – who it was, but it's a mutual fund company that came out and published a study that showed that their best performing accounts were those from their deceased clients.
Yeah,
so those people
had
that, they had no. And then another old timer that I talked to a long time ago at a conference one time, he said, "Son, investments are like soap. The more you touch them, the less you've got."
No, that's true.
Yeah, which is a good one.
Yep.
But yeah, so we've got that, and even if they didn't touch them, like I said, in the real world, there are other factors to consider. An index like the S&P 500 is a non-sentient line. It doesn't have a Social Security number. It doesn't have to pay taxes. It doesn't have to take required minimum distributions. So there are other things that can impact you over time. Not only that, but I would have to say that the vast majority of people cannot tolerate the volatility of the S&P 500 over time, and so they do start to make other decisions. So that being said, they need to build a return assumption that is more realistic in the context of the amount of risk that they're willing or able to assume.
All right, so now we're getting back on track with the original discussion, which was what kind of figures are we looking at to get to that rate of return figure that we need? And that's an important thing to know, the rate of return.
So if we start with the objectives component, right, what are you trying to achieve? We can actually then back out and determine based on what you're able to save, what your income is, what you already have saved up, what your return requirement is, what your required return is, and that would be the starting number, right?
So let me give you a typical example we hear, and you tell me if this is a good answer to that question. What is the figure you're looking for? I'd like to have $1 million by age 65.
Right. Yeah. Okay. You will need to make a lot of money every year. I mean, it all depends on, you know, it depends on where you're starting. But here's the beauty of that: on a calculator that is 3 inches by 5.5 inches, I can figure that out in 24 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we plug those numbers in, boom, we know what the required rate of return is based on all of the other information that we've already collected, right? Like how much you're willing to contribute, how much you can contribute, what assets you already have. You know, if the required rate of return is 50%, given the assets that you're able to contribute to it, obviously we need to start to adjust the expectations and make the expectations more realistic, or figure out, okay, can we contribute more money? Are you going to inherit money at some point in time? Could you get a new job? Could you get a fourth job? But if we can get it down to a manageable rate of return, then the next question, of course, is, you know, okay, how much risk can you tolerate? And really, they're not separate questions. They have to be one and the same. So what is the maximum drawdown in your investment that you could tolerate without starting to make bad decisions? And we kind of blend those two together. We figure out what the required rate of return is and how much risk you could tolerate over a prolonged period of time. And that's when we start to build the portfolio, the investment portfolio, that will meet that return objective. And so it's not a detached process of, if I make 8%, I'll do this or that. And people kind of have it backwards, because the secondary issue with return assumptions like that is that that is an average rate of return. And that is very different than what happens when we're investing, you know, a sequence of returns, specifically if we're contributing periodically. I mean, if you just have one lump sum of money and that's all you're ever going to have, and it's going to grow for 10 years, yes, your average rate of return will be the same as the rate of return earned over a period of a sequence of returns. But if you're contributing at different intervals, that is going to affect it. That is going to change the average rate of return based on the sequence and of returns realized. Or if you're taking money out, it's going to drastically change the average rate of return that's realized.
I'm going to get back to the last question that I asked Nate. And dear listener, this is one of the joys of listening to a completely unscripted show, is that no matter how many leading questions I give to Nate, what I was getting at with that question is, when someone comes in, and we often hear this, I'd like to have $1 million by age 65 or whatever, what we want to ask them is, well, what do you need that to do for you? Because you're not just going to cash out 65, right? You know, when you're age 65, you're not going to cash out $1 million. Well, some people may. But what they're trying to do is get a certain amount of money that will give them income for the rest of their life. And so when we ask people, you know, how much, because $1 million sounds like a lot if someone's never had $1 million before. So we say, well, what do you expect that to actually generate for you? And what a lot of people don't realize is, and I would say this might be a liberal withdrawal assumption, if you take 5% a year out of $1 million, you're only looking at $50,000 a year. And for some people, that may be enough. But a lot of people that say they want to have $1 million are looking at $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 a year, in which case they're going to wipe that sucker out pretty quick. So one of the first things we do is say, well, let's take a look at what you really need to have as a starting balance based on the amount of money you plan on taking out in retirement. And this gets to the difficult part of the discussion we have with a lot of people, which gets back to one of the core issues we're seeing with this retiring baby boomer generation, is their lifestyles are much grander than their parents typically were.
Sure.
And so to try to sustain that lifestyle in retirement once their working years are done, just based on Social Security, maybe a little pension from somewhere, and then the distributions from their retirement accounts, some of them are looking at some pretty massive withdrawal numbers from these retirement accounts.
Right.
And so then we have to have a discussion of, look, do you want to work a lot longer to try to build up some money and have less time for withdrawing, or do you want to cut your lifestyle back? And I'm finding very, very few people are interested in the let's cut the lifestyle back
right.
part of that.
And that's true. It's almost kind of comical that, and I don't know where it came from, but that $1 million was the goal. It's starting to fade now. I'm seeing less and less of it. But over the last, I don't know, probably 10 years really or so, that was like the key number. People would come in, I would like to have $1 million saved. And they hadn't really done the math on how much you could spin off. And a lot of people come in and quote the 4% rule. Well, I can take 4% of that. And a lot of people don't even know that. And so when you tell them that, oh, are you referencing the 4% rule? No, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would, you know, spin off about $40,000.
And what is that 4% rule?
Well, the idea was that 4%, you could withdraw 4% per year from your portfolio and adjust for inflation. And that you would not exhaust those funds over a 30-year span, which is considered, you know, a life expectancy once you've hit retirement age. So if you're tied at age 65, that would put you at 95. And in general, historically anyway, the 4% rule, depending on the portfolio that you've invested in, is not a bad starting point. The problem is that, as in all things finance and economics, it's based on historical information. So In my opinion, it doesn't really matter if it, I mean, it matters insofar as any history matters, but it doesn't really matter if it never, ever, ever, ever failed through all of history, because today is not like every other year that we've experienced. In other words, we need to be looking forward and try to figure out, is this sustainable? Because as we mentioned a couple of shows ago, making those assumptions based on history has gotten huge pension plans in a lot of trouble. And I think that if people retiring today apply history to their retirement distribution, unfortunately, they will be in for a rude awakening.
And even that 4% number, here's another hypothesis that I've got, and we'll see if this one comes true, but I think that may be even a little high, because that's something we've been using for probably the last 20 years. Because to get a sustainable withdrawal rate of 4%, if you want it to last literally forever, if you live another 40 years, then and keep up with inflation, you need to obviously be making a little bit more each year than 4%, which you're taking out of it. So if inflation's 3%, you need to be trying to average around 7%. What's interesting about even that number is when a couple shows ago, we were talking about the rate of return assumptions that these pension managers are using, who are the best of the best of the world.
Right.
Those guys are thinking, we hope we can get 7%. Right. To think the average investor is going to be able to get that is probably a long shot.
Well, and mind you, okay, so a pension has a hypothetically infinite lifespan, whereas the 4% rule, to be fair to the 4% rule, is meant to last 30 years.
Right.
And that's another thing that people don't understand, is that at some point in time, this isn't living off of your interest. I mean, this is, the intention is that you would have $0 by the 30th year.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of folks also don't understand that. We still see a lot of people who come in and want to live off the interest, which, you know, when CDs were paying 17%,
yeah,
that was probably a reasonable consideration, mm-hmm, but the world has changed a little bit. And this, to go full circle, this goes back to the objectives. You can't just say, I want to do this or that. Well, why are you doing this or that?
Mm-hmm.
You want to live off your interest? Okay, well, you're going to live off of 1.235% for the rest of your life, because that's the amount of interest that you're earning in your account right, mm-hmm, now, because you haven't done anything to prepare for the rest of your life.
So to get $100,000 a year, you need about $10 million within
right,
the next 3 years to, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But if you can start with, this is what I'm trying to accomplish, then you can back into all of this, which is the importance of the objectives-based investing or an objectives-based financial planning. One, it does create efficiency. And two, as we mentioned in the last show, it keeps us from making bad decisions when the market gets a little overheated or undervalued. And to kind of just fill in the gaps from the last show, that is one of the big reasons that we want to have those objectives before we enter into an investment strategy with a client. Because if we don't have that in place, what are we doing? Are we just trying to make as much money as possible in any given circumstance? Maybe, you know, if that's their objective, great. But again, make that your objective.
And a lot of times what we see with folks, particularly if they've gotten into their late 40s and especially in their 50s and they're just now starting to think about financial planning, which I get, you know, the kids are finally
sure,
out,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
their expenses and mortgages getting paid,
yep,
down. And they're looking at these things, and sometimes we'll run the numbers. And just to keep them at the current income level they're at now through retirement, I mean, these numbers come back. I mean, they have
they're
to
big.
Save almost more than they make each year.
Right.
And a lot of times the response with folks is, well, I can't do it, so I'll do something a lot less, and we'll just see how it shakes out. But what I would encourage folks to do in those situations is start planning on something realistic. Don't
right.
just say, well, maybe I'll win the lottery or something, and
right.
this will somehow work out. But go do whatever you possibly can, but set up the realistic objective on the front end. Otherwise, we're just all wasting our time here.
And that is frustrating and disappointing, and it is deflating when you speak with someone. And it's not deflating because they say, well, I guess I'll just work forever. But it's deflating because most of the times there are steps that can begin to be taken. You know, we'll still provide a nice life. I mean, we're talking about the prospect of being 65, 70 years old and not having to go to work again, and yet still having enough income to do whatever you want. That is a pretty great thing, particularly when the life expectancy keeps creeping out. You know, a day after day after day, we've got clients coming in and say, yeah, my dad's 94, my mom's 97.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
People are living longer. And so this thing, retirement, is not what, as Nick mentioned, it's not what it was 50 years ago when you were expected to live, you know, 7 years after you retired. I mean, we're talking about close to half of your life without work. And so if we aren't preparing for that far in advance, and sticking to those preparations and tracking them and trying to make sure that we're on track, you would have to expect that you'll be in bad shape.
Let me give you one more scenario and tell me how you would typically deal with it. Sometimes someone will come in and maybe they've got a decent amount of money saved up. Let's say they're in their mid-40s and they've been good about contributing to their retirement plans or IRAs or whatever they've got. Their lifestyle's pretty much in check, but they've gotten to a point where they'd like to try to retire early. And it's funny, you know, as life expectancies get longer, we're hearing more and more people say, I'd love to retire at 55, which is a problem because you can't get to a lot of the qualified assets until 59 and a half. But then they'll say, you know what, and I don't like dealing with the market. I've just always been a conservative investor. And we run all their numbers. We say, here's what you're starting with. Here's what you're saying you can contribute. Here's what you need as your objective for that year you start taking distributions. Your rate of return that you're going to have to try to get is 8% per year. And they go, well, I don't think I can with the market. Do we nudge them to become something they're not as far as more aggressive investors? Or we just say, well, you're going to have to put a lot more money away. I mean, what from an ethical standpoint, do we try to push them into a different psychological state than they may already be?
So there always has to be an education component, right? So, and that's a big part of what we do is trying to help people understand how, and we talked about this last show, how risk can sometimes be used in their favor. But that only goes so far. Again, as we mentioned in the last show, people have a core tendency. They've got this risk tolerance anchor where they can't be pushed beyond that. Mm-hmm. And to be quite honest with you, those folks, the most conservative folks, in my own experience, I know we're speaking hypothetically of someone who is conservative, but they also want these big grand things. In my personal experience, some of those conservative folks end up being the best because they don't have these grand dreams of, well, I'm going to get 10% in the market every year. So they're saving a lot more. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have that first conversation with them and say, yeah, it's fine for you to be a conservative investor, but your rate of return is going to be, you know, at most 3% for most of your life, they save more, right? So if that's what they want, instead of depending on the market to earn its historical average rate of return,
no control over.
They just save more. And so in my personal experience, I find that over a prolonged period of time, those people end up doing better long term.
And let's look at the flip side of that coin. Let's say someone has plenty of assets saved up, their lifestyle is in check, they plan on working to their late 70s, they don't need that much money in retirement, but they say, you know, I'm just not interested. I've always been an aggressive investor. I'd really like to try to just swing for the fences. Is there a certain danger in allowing people to do that, or should we be trying to nudge them to something more conservative if they don't need the risk?
You know, I call that I call those aspirational dollars, right? So I mean, once you have beyond the assets that you need, I mean, if you want to swing for the fence, I mean, and a lot of times that is how some people become truly wealthy, right? Mm-hmm. So when they have so much money that they can take these incredible risks and it doesn't affect their quality of life, I personally don't have a problem with that. I mean, if it gets to the point where it's compromising their quality of life, then again, you have to educate on the dangers of taking excessive risk. But no, I personally don't, if that is what they want to do with their dollars, and if they have the dollars, you know, the assets to do it without compromising that quality of life or their objectives, I personally have no problem with helping them, you know, be as aggressive as possible if that's what they're trying to accomplish.
Even if it puts them in danger of possibly blowing the plan up if they lose a bunch?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you cannot compromise the objectives and you cannot compromise your quality of life. But, and that's why you're not supposed to separate assets into different buckets, but I call them aspirational dollars, right? So those are the dollars that are above and beyond what is required for the plan.
Okay, so maybe set aside and secure up what you know is your good-to-go money
lose every dollar of your aspirational dollars, and it would not affect your quality of life, and it would not affect your objectives, what you're trying to accomplish. And like I said, I mean, depending on the investments that they want to undertake, yeah, they could lose it all, but also, you know, sometimes it works out, and people make a lot of money and they can continue.
So the moral of this episode has been kind of, and I like the way we're going with this because it gives people a little peek into the day in the life of the financial advisor. I mean, there's a lot of things that we just experience through experience that you can't learn in a textbook. And a lot of that has to do with human behavior and a lot of the mistakes that we're seeing people make. And the focus of this show has been, look, first and foremost, you need to focus on what your objectives are. Nothing else really matters that you're doing and could put you at quite a bit of risk if you don't at least know what you're shooting for and have some sort of plan in place that you can adhere to try to get to that objective. Otherwise, you're just swinging for the fences and kind of taking shots in the dark, and who knows how it may turn out.
And I would even say, and unfortunately, we didn't talk about objectives as much as we had intended to in this show, so maybe
we said it enough times that we could pull it off.
I would just say, though, that first and foremost, you have to know yourself. So you have to take an inventory of your finances, which is one of the biggest hurdles to get people into the process of financial planning is you have to know where all of your stuff is. You have to know, you know, how much you're making, how much you're spending, and from there, then you can start to talk about your objectives. But that is one of the big ones. That's one of the hard ones to get folks to take the time to do that, which is a process.
The word of the day is objective.
We've talked about objectives.
Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next time on the IRA Brothers Podcast.